Welcome to Hot D, the officially unofficial podcast for House of the Dragon on HBO. I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron.
And we're back to talk the season finale of House of the Dragon, The Black Queen. Aaron, how are you feeling about this episode now?
Thanks for just bringing the excitement there. The season finale, The Black Queen. I'm pumped, dude. I thought this was an incredible way to end the season. So I'm trying to make up for this energy. Overall... Okay. You know, I talked about this in the preview podcast. I was kind of on pins and needles about this show because, you know, not for nothing. It means a lot to Bald Move, you know, to have a big audience that's excited about something. And it was a real kick in the nuts to the community and to our enterprise here when Game of Thrones kind of fell off. And I was really hoping that all that enthusiasm and love for Westeros, which I think was real, would translate. And I thought there was some banger moments in this here book, Fire and Blood, that I'm banging on. You can't see it because it's a podcast. It's just that, like, man, there was not much emotion or much depth to the characters. And when I saw the premiere, and then now that I got the whole season, like, I'm feeling really good about however many seasons we get out of House of the Dragon. I guess the one thing I'd worry about now is them trying to stretch it too far. But it sounds like they've got maybe plans long term for a whole Targaryen anthology. So we can just jump around to all the interesting parts of the Targaryen dynasty, which I think would make some really compelling content unless people get sick of incest and succession wars, because that's kryptonite. If people are like, you know, I'm all done with incest bastards and people scheming for Iron Thrones, then they got a long term problem. But until that day comes, I think the future's bright, and I thought it did a couple of amazing things. I thought it really did one of the things I underline in the book is, like, this is going to be a fucking baller moment in the show where a dragon gets chomped by Vhagar, and they nailed it, but they also added the dimension with Aemon kind of not really wanting that to happen that honestly surprised me as a book reader, and the more I think about it, the more I really like it and what it does to the story. I've even kind of, this episode has turned me around on Princess Rhaenys running away from the King's Landing last episode.
Like, yeah,
I think I believe her when she says, yeah, it's war's gonna come from this probably, but you know what, it's not my war to start. That's actually a huge sign of respect to Rhaenyra. I don't know, maybe that's a cope. But I genuinely feel it at this point. I thought this episode is amazing into a very, very satisfying first season of Game of Thrones, House of the Dragon, which again is just a prelude to what I think is the good part. So I'm feeling pretty good as Lord Commander of this operation. How's the King feeling?
Yeah, especially as a pair with last episode and this one, I feel like those are... That's two great flavors that go great together. The green and the black flavor. I liked seeing both sides of this kind of in isolation. It gave like a sense of like there is this rift between the two sides, right? Obviously, there's a rift, but it felt like that while watching the episodes. Like, there was information on one side, there was a lack of information on the other, and it made
Fog
that super
war.
Obvious. Yeah, yeah. So I was really feeling that the second time around. But yeah, I think this is a great way to end this season. It leaves me with questions about, you know, what is Daemon up to? How are people going to respond to the events of this episode? But it felt very satisfying. It was like, okay, they gave us one more big moment for the end of this season. A bigger moment, I think, than, you know, Rhaenys busting up through the floor and just breathing hot air into the King's face and then flying off. And I felt like this final dragon scene here worked a lot better than that scene did, but you're right. Like this goes halfway, I think, to fixing the problem of last episode that I saw with that Rhaenys dragon busting scene. I will say, I think it's crazy the rationale that they gave for it in the inside the episode stuff. I don't see that anywhere on screen, really. Maybe slightly, but that's not how Rhaenys explains it at all. So
no.
I don't know what they were doing with that particular interview, but this makes a lot more sense than whatever shit they were spouting in that interview section.
Honestly, I think this makes us look, if people have followed along with our podcast, the show itself and the behind the scenes, I think this has so validated our stance of that shit doesn't matter. Because this is like the third or fourth time that I think a showrunner has just completely given an opposite point of view from what is on film. And I think it's to preserve secrets that they later want to, you know, like that rationale that they gave for Daemon punking out on Rhaenyra in the Pleasure House. Like that didn't like, oh, he's just fucking impotent. Like,
no, I mean,
that's like, you know, like
it's Obi-Wan Kenobi from a certain point of view shit, right? Like,
but they're in, it's like either can say nothing or they can say something that gives away spoilers and stuff. So it's like, I think like, look, I mean, there is some stuff that's good. I was pretty moved by Emma Darcy's description of like the depths of grief that Rhaenyra gets to. There's some stuff that is complimentary, but like you can't treat that as gospel or canon for sure. Like if they want, like, you know, if they need that to explain something, then they fucked up in the filming. And if they don't, then it's all just like somebody's opinion, man. So yeah, I think those things are trash as far as explaining people's motivations, it seems.
Yeah, because they seem to go back on those. But yeah, I really enjoyed this episode. All right, what do you say we get into the recap?
I would love to, but since, you know, this is our kind of last swing at the enhanced audience of House of the Dragon, I just want to let people know that Bald Move is not folding shop for the next 2 years. We are still doing stuff. Even on this feed, Maester Anthony is going to be returning very soon to start a brand new chapter-by-chapter discussion of Clash of Kings, which is the second book of Game of Thrones. He just finished a chapter-by-chapter discussion of Game of Thrones, its sequel. So we'll be starting that in a couple of weeks. Jim and I will be returning from time to time because Maester Anthony takes breaks every 10 chapters or so to recharge his batteries, and we'll get in there to be talking about House of the Dragon off-season news, Jon Snow sequel, news that should be starting rolling in, any other kind of developments in the world of Ice and Fire. But there's lots of other stuff that we got coming up. We are closing out The Walking Dead, its final season. If there's, you know, two or three of you that are interested in that. Also, 1899, the prequel sequel spiritual successor to Netflix's Dark, which is one of the best time travel series I've ever seen. It's amazing. Is coming on November 17th. We'll be covering that. We'll also be doing first run movie coverage of Wakanda Forever. We got a whole Bald Move Christmas celebration coming up, which is always fun, where we go back and we do a bunch of fun Christmas movies. We also have, looking forward to 2023, we're looking forward to the debut of The Last of Us, which is a new post-apocalyptic zombie show with a twist that's going to be on HBO. I think it's going to be amazing. It's got a great pedigree. Craig Mazin. Is that his name, Mazin or Maislin? Mm-hmm. You might recognize him as the showrunner for Chernobyl. It's such a great, great creative choice to put him as the head of The Last of Us. It's got Pedro Pascal, Prince Oberyn, the Viper himself leading it. It's going to be amazing. Oh,
and Mormont.
Lady Mormont.
Yeah.
Little Lady Mormont.
As Ellie.
From late season. It's you guys, if you haven't played the video game, I think it's going to be amazing. We also have, looking forward to, return of Yellow Jackets, Severance, Foundation, tons and tons of stuff on Bald Move. And you can get it all if you want to get all of our pulp coverage at Bald Move Pulp. Just wherever you listen to podcasts, Bald Move Pulp. And you'll be assured of getting all of our zombie, science fiction, ray gun, dragon writing, magic casting podcasts. Okay, now we're ready to go into the episode. There's still lots of hot D to talk about. We'll be back right after the break.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off Badass Season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints, except it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
And now, back to Hot D.
All right, we start off with Luke telling his mother he doesn't want to be the Lord of Driftmark. Rhaenyra encourages him by telling him that she was scared when she had to do her duty and become the heir, and that she'll be there to help him. And then Sir Loren announces that Rhaenys has arrived and wants to talk to her and Daemon.
Yep, the bastard gives us one last, I didn't wanna, and before he dies. But this is such an interesting contrast between Alicent. You know, like, this kid comes and essentially says, I don't want to do my duty, and Rhaenyra does not slap him and call him a worthless piece of shit, but, like, empathizes with him. You know, like, hey, I wasn't ready when I got tapped to be heir. Mm-hmm. You're probably not ready, but my dad helped me, just like I'm going to help you. You know, like, you got to do your duty. You got to earn it. This is something you got to prove, you know. You're right to feel inadequate, kind of. But, like, you know, how can you shore that up? I thought this was pretty good parenting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it's touching seeing Rhaenyra interact with her kids there. And what she says to him, I think, yeah, is encouraging, right? Like, telling a child that you were scared, you felt what they feel at some point in your life, makes them identify with you and understand that they can get past it, right?
Yeah.
Makes a lot of sense.
And I loved her amusement as a parent to her child calling her perfect. Like, I'm just not like you, Mom. I'm not so perfect. And, like, mm-hmm. you know, we as Rhaenyra enjoy, along with her, you know, being with her, kind of riding along in her life, like, the irony of that statement.
Right.
But I thought it's a great scene. Great calm before the storm scene.
Sir Loren, Kingsguard, Queensguard?
Yeah.
Do you call it Kingsguard when there's a queen on the throne?
Probably not. It is, in fact, canonically called the Queensguard.
Nice.
And he's going to be drafted in one of... I'll have a rundown of these guys here coming up when we get to the other one.
Okay. It seems like he's Rhaenyra's guard, but I'd like to know more about them. So then we go to Rhaenys telling Daemon and Rhaenyra everything that happened at King's Landing, including the death and the usurping of her title. Daemon thinks it was murder because he's itching for a fight. The news causes Rhaenyra to have a miscarriage, apparently. She's mm-hmm. temporarily sidelined as she deals with it. And while she is, Daemon plans the defense of Dragonstone.
I am very amazed at how this show continues to use, you know, a lot of people are making fun of it, like, you know, how many childbirths can you have in one season, but every one mm-hmm. of them has been distinct and different. And this one, like, Rhaenyra almost cursing her body, you know, like, I want to be in the room where it's happening, and I'm in this room with these goddamn wet, you know, the doulas or whatever, birthing maids, and it sucks. And this, like, you know, they mentioned in the after episode that this is kind of like her being at war with herself, like this war, what her family across the Blackwater Bay is doing is literally tearing her apart. And I thought, like, it's just this felt like, you know, going back to the first episode, Queen Emma telling us, you know, this is our fate as royals. You know, our battle's the birthing bed. Rhaenyra's mm-hmm. having to do both. Like, this is a real fight, like, filmed like a fight, you know, with different moves and phases and stuff. And I just thought, you know, it's you don't usually see childbirth like this depicted on film.
No, you do not. And we've seen a lot of them. Yes. The funny thing is, no one would be complaining if we had seen like 5 battle scenes. Right.
Right.
They'd be like, oh, you God, know, another battle scene. The fuck?
You know, there's something to what you say, Jim.
So, yeah, I'm they're harrowing scenes. They're almost all across the board. Extremely harrowing scenes. And I definitely feel them every time we get one. This one's a particularly nasty one. I was going to say nobody died. I guess the baby died. It's you know, it's weird. It almost stretches believability that like this bad news caused a miscarriage. I thought at the end, hilariously, I thought at the end of the episode, oh, she gets the news about Luke and just has another miscarriage, right? There was another baby rattling around in there.
She got made her spontaneously pregnant and miscarried simultaneously.
Yeah.
I was like,
here we go again.
That's certainly what it's portrayed. And it's how Rhaenyra, especially in the book, she makes it personal. Like, this shit this war has already cost me my daughter. I'm bellicose from the beginning, and everyone else is trying to calm her down. I thought it's interesting to make her the kind of voice of reason despite all this stuff happening.
Yeah.
But it's like, I got it like that, like, you know, nature's on a timetable of its own, and it just like she was going to miscarry this day regardless because there's some abnormalities to this fetus that I think was hinted at on the screen, but certainly made explicit in the book. And it just so happened to coincide. Maybe the stress of the mother accelerated it a couple hours. But, like, I think it's one of those things that it's a coincidence. But it's something that, like, it's such a powerful metaphor that, like, you know, yeah, that's certainly be part of the lore and the telling of the story, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's my only real, even minor gripe with this episode is that seems like a big coincidence. I wish they had time, and they didn't in the episode, but I wish they had time to show like she was having some pains before this news came in. But it's like
they did have
as Rhaenys tells her the news, she's like, fetus. Yeah.
Like I said, I think the stress can like it's something that was going to happen in hours or days, and maybe the stress. Like, I'm not an obstetrician, I'm not an OBGYN. I'm a humble Lord Commander of the Kingsguard here. So I'm just going, like, I thought it was pretty cool dramatic, especially since like this thing has this whole season's been framed by births and deaths and miscarriages and the struggle that women have gone through historically, just fucking bringing forth the next generation. So like, you know, like bringing that like full circle, I thought it was pretty good. And essentially, again, since it's like, you know, you felt the struggle of the realm as personified through the struggle that Rhaenyra is going through with her own body, I thought that, yeah, that really worked for me.
And just emotionally, like, this is such a huge defeat for Rhaenyra. Like, you think of all the things she's done over her life for her duty, right? And thinking that this is finally the moment where it all pays off.
Yeah.
And instead, it's all been taken from her. Like, all those years she spent, all the fake sham marriages, all of the lies about the parentage of her children, all of the stuff that she didn't want to do. And now she did it all, but it's for nothing. It's brutal.
Yeah.
And here she's doing it again, right? It's like, she is. I really like what Emma Darcy says about the motivations of Rhaenyra, because she is the only person in the room who's not rushing headlong into war. She's trying to make yet another sacrifice to keep the realm united. She's potentially going to give up, like I said, everything that she's worked for, just to keep the realm together, which is her father's dying wish. So
I
really felt for her in this moment. It was a big blow getting this news.
All that aside, I thought I had a tremendous respect for the episode, because the big question I had coming out of last week is, why the fuck did Rhaenys not just melt everybody down? And having Daemon exactly be the audience surrogate and be like, how did you moonwalk out of there? Why aren't our enemies lying dead at our feet already? Why? And her being like, yeah, I know that this is going to mean war. And I'm not cognizant of that, but like, it's also not my war to be. I thought that was really powerful because it's almost like she trusted Rhaenyra to maybe find a different way. Like, yeah, maybe we have to go. Also, it feels like at the end of this episode that the blacks have a not unwarranted sense of confidence. Like, they need two of the three or four lords that they're, you know, but they don't probably need all of them because they do have a massive advantage of the fleet. They do have a massive advantage in dragons. They even have like a territorial control of the narrow sea geographically, which I'll lay out later on. So it's like, I think that there's this idea of like, you know, the Greens are having an emotional reaction and are throwing a hissy fit. But we're going to offer them reverse generous terms and remind them of like, yeah, you got the biggest dragon, but how many of our mature dragons will it take to take down, you know, Vhagar? And if we ever do, it's going to be your ass. So like, you know, we're going to choke King's Landing until you decide. Like that seems like it has a chance of working.
Yeah.
And if they just went right to Fire and Blood, you know, it that will also work. But God knows what it's going to do to King's Landing, the capital city, what it's going to do to the surrounding area. So I actually this actually entirely fits within Rhaenys's character, as I understand it. She's very pragmatic and practical, as is Rhaenyra. So like I thought it was great. They have completely won me around to like. It had been an understandable but shitty strategic and tactical decision to do all that kinslaying, whereas it's so optically confident to the people. It's like, can you imagine what the small folk of King Land is like? Melee's just like fucking popped out of ground, screamed at this bullshit king, and then ran off to tell Queen Rhaenyra who's going to come and give them all a smacking. Like, that's a powerful narrative if they can back it up.
Sure. No, I really like the disposition of the two different sides and their armies at the end of this episode, or at least the theoretical future disposition, right? They talk about a scenario where they could potentially surround King's Landing, and I go, okay, maybe you could surround it. Can you hold that? Because they're going to have a lot of, King's Landing is going to have a lot of support on the ground. So we'll see. We'll see.
Yeah. And, you know, like I said, there'll be some key things that we'll talk about. But I think it's certainly last episode, I think you could be forgiven if, like, well, the Greens have just pulled off this coup d'etat and there's just nothing you can do about it. Like, it's game, set, match. But it's like, yes, on paper, but it really remains to be seen. And all the most all the air and sea supremacy is entirely in Rhaenyra's hands at the end of this episode. So what do the Greens do about that? It's really great. They're A+ how they're developing this.
All right. Rhaenys fetches Rhaenyra's two oldest boys and tells them the news. Rhaenyra tells him the news. Then Jace gets marching orders from his mother that nothing is to be done until she commands it, and he leaves to make sure that Daemon abides by that order.
I've listened to a lot of coverage of this episode from our peers and colleagues, and a lot of people have bad feelings about Daemon, which fair enough. After this episode, but starting here with like him organizing the defense of Dragonstone and kind of why she is a bed.
Why?
I mean, I don't you need know. To defend.
You,
I don't know.
King's Landing is like a quick dragons right away. They could That's be sending dragons saying. Right now.
Like, what if Daemon goes alive and holds her hand for 12 hours through and breathes what's like, that'd be a great husband thing to do. Sure. But what good is it if they fucking land a faceless, like three boats of faceless men, the two dragons, and a longboat, you know, 500 longboats with 100 you got to kind of take care of, like, this is about survival. This is, you are going through an active crisis.
Yeah.
I didn't have a problem with Daemon. Like, maybe I like the balance of Jace standing up to him. Because this guy is a scary dude, you know?
Totally.
And he's like, I'm going to enforce my mother's will. And the fact that Rhaenyra is keeping control, even though she's not in a room where things are happening. Like, but Daemon organized it. I don't know. I felt like even like I'd let him send some ravens, which I think is kind of like where the power struggle kind of landed. You can't just sit and be flat-footed.
No, I agree. Yeah, the defense. Like, it'd be one thing if he were pushing an offense here, but he's not, right? He's playing their defense, which
I think
is
he would
smart
push
and necessary.
Like, if Jace doesn't come in the room, I think he gets around to planning an offense pretty quick.
Yeah, that was next on the list after the Ravens, right?
Yeah.
I was like,
then
we're going to send dragons to King's Landing. Yeah.
Yeah. What'd you think of Jace kind of bullying his brother there on the beach, it seemed like?
Bullying his brother on the beach?
Yeah, like when Rhaenys comes out to get him, like, he had just shoved his brother down and he's like, no, what were you thinking? I just wonder if you had any thoughts, because I had, or if your thoughts matched mine, I guess.
Luke seems to be a fairly weak fighter, I'll say that. I don't think Jace is much better, but Jace is older. I think he's just trying to toughen his brother up because he knows maybe not a fight for the realm necessarily, but he's going to need some strength.
That's, I thought that, like, Aemon backing them the fuck off at their granddad's last feast, you know?
Yeah.
It's like, you know, this is the second time this guy has kind of like outfought me and intimidated me. And he's clearly like sharp as a blade and hard as this guy is. I think he's like, because he is a dutiful guy. He's like, I've got to up my game. Like, I've been concentrating on learning High Valyrian and my P's and Q's and I've got a fucking war on my hand. So like, I think that's, but there's also, I think, shades of the fact that, like, you know, just like Otto impressed upon Alicent that you are under attack. There's a little bit of that where it's like the kids are learning the lessons that the adults have taught them too well, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, it's the tragedy of this season, honestly. So then we go to where Daemon gets word that Corlys is feeling better and has left Evenfall, where he was recovering. They don't know where he's headed, though, which I think is giving everybody a little bit of pause. Like, which side is he going to pledge for here?
Yes.
Daemon plans to fly out to the Tullys, but Jace arrives and tells him to cool his jets. Daemon has some ravens sent and gathers a couple Kingsguard to meet with him and Jace. And we'll get to the result of that here in a second. Corlys survived. I mean, obviously, if you've seen this episode, you know that. But that was a super interesting point of tension for me, because nobody really knows yet how Valyrians are going to declare.
Yeah.
And that seems to be the balance of power shifting just with their declaration, right? I mean,
yeah,
if they declare for green, it's over pretty much.
They still have the dragons and they're still, but it's
a much harder
path
fight.
Forward is much harder because like it's you've essentially, instead of encircling King's Landing now is a wall that you can't breach except by air. So,
yeah.
And you got to risk your dragons to do that.
Yeah. And it evens the odds. I mean, if you, not completely, but it certainly gives them more dragons.
Yeah.
I get the impression that Rhaenys is a pretty formidable dragon rider.
Yeah, and Melis, their dragon, is known to be pretty fierce, the Red Queen herself. I thought it was, so like, they mentioned three houses here, Darkland, Massey, and Bar Ammon. These are essentially houses, the Blackwater Bay is in this, you know, big bay. King's Landing is at the extreme western end where the Blackwater River meets it. So it's like this big sheltered port, which is great. But all of these lords they mention are at the mouth of that bay, or I guess at the where it turns into the sea. Yeah, the mouth of the bay. So, like, geographically, they would be isolating King's Landing because you'd have to get past all of these. They already have Dragonstone, which sits in the middle of Blackwater Bay. They got Driftmark, which also sits in the... Now they'd be owning both of the points of the peninsulas that kind of encircle it. They have, even without Corlys's power, they would have a pretty good strong claim of control over the sea entry to King's Landing. And again, King's Landing is Westeros's largest, most important port. So I thought it was interesting. And like House Darkland also has kind of an interesting story throughout the world of Ice and Fire. And I think I'm going to do my Maester's Corner on the Darklands of Duskendale. In the feedback episode.
Okay.
So look forward to that. A little oral history. Now you know the whole story behind the Darklands.
Yeah. Sounds interesting. And I guess... So let me ask you about this. He definitely doesn't know whether to trust Corlys yet. I'm talking about Daemon here. he also is asked, do you want to speak to the Maester about these ravens that they're going to send? And he just like stares daggers at the guy who suggested.
Mm-hmm.
Does he not trust the Maesters in this situation? Is he, like, what is his deal? Do you want to speak to the Maester, my prince? And he just glares at him.
I think it's because Rhaenyra in the background is screaming his name. And
oh, it's not about the ravens.
It's not about the ravens. Okay. It's about the condition of your wife and what the fuck is happening in the next room. And he's like,
gotcha.
I am not going to be distracted from this duty right now.
That makes a lot of
but
sense.
But I don't know. Yeah. Maybe in your preparations for the defense of your family's actual life, you can spare 30 seconds to go to your wife and be like, hey, look, I hear. But like, you know, also, I'm just calling her banners and deploying her forces. Is that cool? Like, yeah. But, you know, that's not how Damon is.
No, not at all. And I love how sheepishly he walks in after it's all over, like the defense is planned and she's, you know, dealt with the birth situation. He's just like looking at the floor and it's just a real
fucking bummer, you know, like, they didn't get a happy result from the birth. And
Jesus, no,
I don't think they come out and say this in the show, but in the novel, this is Rhaenyra's first daughter. She's got like a reverse problem her father had, where she just couldn't get a female to carry on the line of women badasses. And it's like, especially, you know, I think that would be an especially grievous thing. Is like, you know, you probably, you know, it's like, oh God, I finally had a daughter, someone that could understand my side of the thing. And look, it got ruined by this fucking war.
Yeah. All right, Damon takes the couple of Kingsguard outside and forces them to renew their oaths for Rhaenyra under the threat of dragonfire. And kind of simultaneously, Rhaenyra is in her chambers forcing this baby out. Like, literally, just like all her will, get out of me, she's saying. It's, of course, stillborn because it's way premature. She wraps it for the funeral pyre and then they burn it. We're going to kind of stop mid-scene there. There's still lots of hot D left to talk about. We'll be right back after the break. And now, back to hot D.
Yeah. I talked about the Queensguard, the former Kingsguard who are going to be inducted into the Queensguard. Yes, you've got Sir Stefan Darklyn. And I'm going to be talking about the Darklyns of Duskendale in the feedback episode in the Maester's Corner. You got Sir Laurent Marbrand. Sir Stefan Darklyn is the one that's got... it looks like he's slightly older, but he's the one with hair. And Laurent Marbrand is the one without hair. And if you're not a book reader, do not Google these gentlemen. Please, just don't ever Google any of these people's names, because like, their story begins and ends right here. They're just fourth and fifth bananas on the Kingsguard, and now they're part of the Queensguard, and their history starts here, and it's all horrific spoilers for what's going to come on House of the Dragon season 2 and 3. So just don't do it. Just don't do it. That's who they are. You'll get to know them in due time. But yeah, don't fucking do it. Don't do it. Don't Google it.
Oh, I hope they're not turned cloaks.
I still, again, thought this was a sour note. Like, honestly, in the book, Damon is shown as one of the cooler heads, who's like,
wow,
cognizant of the dangers the dragons prove to each other,
right?
Who doesn't want to rush into things, and who is kind of like urging, let's get our banners together, let's get our shit together, let's encircle this thing, let's do. And I thought it was weird, but like, I guess like for characterization, maybe more consistent to have him kind of be the temperamental hothead, you know, like he's the fire in the relationship.
That's what I've been feeling all series so far.
Yeah. Yeah, but I thought you just don't treat, like, this is just such a horseshit way to treat people who are supposed to take this duty as sacred, you know? And also, like, what the fuck are they supposed to say?
Right.
Like, get this horrifying lizard behind me is going to burn you alive and eat you.
Mm-hmm.
Or you can promise not to hurt my wife, the queen. Or at some point later in the future, if we win this fucking war and you turn cloak, I promise you'll die an even worse death than being burnt alive and eaten by this giant fucking lizard behind me. Already a horrifying prospect that I'm sure you're sitting here in your car driving, commuting, or, you know, doing the dishes, whatever you live. You can't even conceive of the horror of being burnt alive by a lizard and eaten. This is some horse shit that they're putting the Kingsguard through, I think.
Yeah, and but I will say for them, if they do eventually turn on Rhaenyra, that they are better liars than Lord Caswell. Lord Caswell is so shifty looking as he stares into every corner of the room. They're just like, nope, we're good.
Yeah, like that. Yeah, he'd be the if any of these guys, if like Sir Laurent was like Caswell, he'd be as soon as Daemon turns his back, like halfway, his cloak would start to shift.
Yeah.
What are you turning your cloak? No. Just I had a wrinkle. Oh. It just looked weird from this angle. I'm just kind of airing it. Yeah. No.
Yeah.
Did we talk about the actual birth itself?
I wanted to get to that because this is a birthing scene. Jesus.
And they also like the you know, like her screaming in unison with Syrax. I think that's supposed to have like that's happening simultaneously somewhere in the Dragon Mount. It really implies there is this kind of psychic connection. It's more than just like Valyrian commands, because, you know, I've been trying to be agnostic about this, and I know what the book says and I know what the fucking Wikipedia say. But I'm really curious about what the show is going to say about these dragons. And this episode is an intriguing mixed bag, because like maybe the dragons have too much of a psychic bond that you have to have a certain amount of strength of will and character to not let your emotions unduly affect your steed.
Yeah.
You know, the effect of controlling them. Also, throughout this episode, I kept on thinking what Viserys said in the very first episode. Our control of the dragons is an illusion. I thought he was talking about poetically, you know, like that kind of thing. But like, I think there might be some actual truth. As a guy who rode the biggest and baddest dragon of all time and never wanted to do it again, him saying that like we are kind of like barely, if not in control of these things. This episode really kind of crystallized those two things. That yes, the Targaryens aren't bullshitting when it comes to some kind of connection, but also it's a two-way street.
Yeah, absolutely. As far as the birth itself goes, was I supposed to be picking up on some irregularities in this birth? Because honestly, I don't know what like a 5 month old stillborn is supposed to look like. So it's hard for me to tell if there was anything quote unquote wrong.
Well, I don't think
baby.
You're supposed to understand it's that premature. It's like, you know, I don't know. Like maybe you are a couple
months from full term.
But I thought, you know, just looking at it, it seemed like its head was pretty misshapen and deformed. The back of it was very lumpy and weird.
Is that normal? That feels normal for an unborn baby.
You can have a baby with a football shaped head because it's squeezed out the birth canal, but like multiple bumps and Klingon kind of protrusions, not so much. And I think definitely you're supposed to understand that it had a missing or malformed leg. Like there's a leg, and then there was its like, you know, pubic cleft, and then there's just kind of like this nubbin, maybe.
And
the book explicitly, the book says the infant was twisted and malformed with a hole in its chest where its heart should have been, and sporting a stubby, scaly tail. That last part from Mushroom. But you know what?
Yeah.
Mushroom's been right a hell of a lot more than he's been wrong in this book thus far.
What's the purpose of that? Why have the queen deliver what was obviously going to be a really deformed baby?
I think it's the fact that, like, she is fighting this war. She is actually fierce. And that this war is already costing her something. Because in the book, it's made explicit. I don't know in the show that, like, she blames the Greens for this happening. That they've
cursed
her.
Sure, I get the point of her, having this miscarriage and the sacrifice of that. I understand that. But the specifically the deformities. Like, why have this baby be... A baby that clearly wouldn't have survived even if it had come to full term.
Like what is Martin getting at? That's a good question, because there is a lot of weird misshapen Targaryen births. And as someone joked in the instant talk, it's like, that's not surprising. You keep marrying sister to brother, brother to sister.
Right.
Niece to nephew. Like, you're going to get a fuck. But like, maybe it's just that. But there's also there's also some, you know, lore, like deeper kind of lore theories that we don't know if they're ever going to come to fruition because Martin hasn't finished his fucking books. But there's hints that like there might be something like human dragon hybrid that like, you know, there's been theories like how do you get dragons in the first place? Are, you know, dragons like literally evolved? Or get, like there's a couple of kind of like and there's something like Dany's baby was like this. They said Tyrion is like this. There's all kinds of like wild, exotic, time traveling fetus theories in the Valyrian tinfoil stuff and stuff. So it's like, I don't know. It just I took it when I read it. It's like, oh, another twisted Targaryen baby to throw into the pile of either genetic unfortunates from inbreeding or Martin fucking around with some kind of prophetic thing. But again, nothing has come to fruition. So it's hard to say.
It sounds like some fucked up Qyburn type stuff. Like he'd be experimenting with trying to combine
dragons and humans. So like if dragons require some sort of blood magic to bind, and there is some, you know, I looked up the meaning of Daemon's song that he's singing to Vermithor, and there's something that we'll get to here in a bit. But like, you know, in the Game of Thrones universe, there seems to be some kind of life for life requirement or some kind of blood magic visits some kind of cost on the living. And there's been a lot of dragon eggs being hatched, a lot of dragon eggs being laid. And is this the other shoe dropping from Daemon being so proud of finding that clutch of three? Something to think about. I don't know.
Interesting.
Nothing I think you can prove in the text, but it's a connection that some of the lore meisters have been keeping an eye on.
We talked about the connection between Rhaenyra's birth and her dragon, but there's a disconnect here that I like in this scene too, and it's Daemon and Rhaenyra. They're both feeling the loss of this child. They're both feeling the loss of Viserys, but they're feeling it separately, right? He's out on the cliffside, just kind of kneeling down. I don't know whether he's praying for war or what, but
this is the second time it's happened to Daemon. Like, you know, he lost his first wife over it.
He might be praying for her safety. I don't know. But like,
right.
Yeah,
that's why I was getting. There's a lot of stuff that he's feeling just like Rhaenyra is. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And it's not usually as clear with Daemon, right? Because you look at him and you say, well, he's a very angry and quick to wrath and all these things. So I don't know if he's angry here, if he's really feeling some genuine sorrow, but
I think, you know, with his shoulders slumped, falling, like him and Rhaenyra both, like he falls to his knees, braced on his sword, Dark Sister on the beach. She falls to her knees as she's kind of like, you know, keeping the Silent Sisters at arm's length and kind of doing the funerary customs for her own infant here. I think it's both. I think there's enough rage and grief and sorrow to go around for both of them.
All right, so we're midway in this scene here after the funeral pyre where they burn the child. The Black Twin shows up and he pledges himself to Rhaenyra, giving her Viserys' crown, which he stole before leaving King's Landing. And then Daemon crowns her queen and everyone except for Rhaenys bows and takes a knee.
This is a great scene. Like, I like how closely they tied this. This is so much better than in the books because, like, narratively, this is Rhaenyra at her lowest point, right? You know, she's just suffered this grievous personal loss. Her husband's feeling it. Everything has just been a bummer after bummer after bummer. And they haven't even, and Team Black hasn't even really done anything yet but send a raven or two. And here comes this loyal King's Guardian who's going to be a Queen's Guardian with big King V's crown that he's stolen and he's going to put on her head. Like, you don't have, you know, it's like, it's just a, it's the turning point where things stop sucking and things get better for Team Black. And then things start sucking again. But
I like it because this is the light crown, right? Versus the dark crown. You get the egg on the conqueror's crown that's almost black.
Iron, cruel, unyielding.
You've got this beautiful golden crown from Viserys, and they represent conquering versus the peacetime.
Good
right?
times, Vizzy T, yeah.
Uh-huh.
Vizzy V, rather. V is Vizzy T. Never mind.
He's Vizzy T. And so I have to think that is sort of ringing in her ears too, right? She sees this crown. She knows what kind of king he was. And taking over that mantle this directly with this symbol is it has got to be telling her, like, keep the realm together. Don't make this about you. This is about
symbolism.
Yeah. This is about the Song of Ice and Fire.
Yeah.
I really like this moment. And Damon being the one to crown her here, I think, is just a really special moment for them. Yeah, it's all good.
Yeah, Basifor says he's his queen. Everyone bows except for Rhaenys. What'd you make of that?
Yeah, I mean, we talked a little bit about it on the instant take. I felt like Rhaenys was still not willing to declare for anyone here. And I don't, she's still figuring out who Rhaenyra is going to be and who Rhaenyra has been, right? She's trying to determine, okay, did she kill my son? What kind of leader is she going to be? Is she worthy of me pledging myself to her? And so her not kneeling here makes a lot of sense, especially in light
I agree.
She doesn't feel like she has the right, much the way she doesn't have the right to start this war, she doesn't have the right to pledge House Valyrian to Rhaenyra because Corlys is going to return.
Also, I thought it was really clever how they staged this, that she's literally the last person in this crowd. So, like, no one can see her not kneeling. Something where she can maintain fidelity to her husband, to her house. She can show respect to Rhaenyra. And no one sees the, like, minor act of defiance or neutrality. Right. I thought it's like, yeah, like, what's it going to cost her? Nothing.
Mm-hmm. I kept thinking through this whole episode, okay, this is the moment where the Civil War starts, right? Like, the queen being crowned queen is the moment where it kicks off. Boy, I didn't see the end of this coming, because that's quite obviously the moment.
I thought it was interesting, too. Dave Chin speculated on this on his podcast, and I think I've confirmed it by looking at the photo. This is the same spot that Damon and Rhaenyra got married.
Oh,
so it's like this has, you know, it's got this little stone altar. This is where they got married. This is where they've cremated their third child, their first daughter. And this is where she's crowned, like, on the spot. Like, there's a lot of spiritual and political significance to this spot, which I thought was kind of cool. A nice kind of through point that they've done with this back half of the season.
Makes me think it won't be the last time we see that location.
Probably not. Probably not. Don't drag a stone altar up to some godforsaken place in Northern Ireland or wherever the hell this is and not going to use it again.
Right. Okay. The painted table is lit up and they get the war markers out. Queen Rhaenyra presides over the war planning session as they run down their assets and allies. Rhaenys abstains from pledging her support because Corlys will return soon. Daemon clearly is out for blood. He's pushing to surround King's Landing with dragons. The Black Twin interrupts to say that a green ship is approaching. I was amazed. I did not realize that this table could light up. But when they started lighting up that table and I realized, like, how it lights up and how cool it was going to look, I was blown away.
Yeah, it's something that's like medievally plausible. You get some kind of soapstone and you carve it shallow. It's like it's essentially like a pumpkin and you paint the surface. Uh-huh. Like painted table has always been like, oh, it's painted to be realistically accurate, but like it's painted so it doesn't shine. Dude, it was in fact like 100 people have already suggested through feedback. This has got to be season 2's opening credits. It's
got to
be this painted table. You can see the markers move across it as battles happen and as houses fall and declare. You can have areas of the table flame out if they've been like, oh, yeah, if you come on. Okay, maybe your blood waterfalls were cool for this season for the prologue. But we need some fucking maps, man. I'm getting tired of trying to explain to people that going from Dragonstone to King's Landing is not jetpacking. It's commuter flighting at best. Like, at worst.
Yeah, no, I hope that they will do something. It doesn't necessarily have to be the painted table, but I do hope that they're willing to admit that that really added nothing to the show, is this bloodline.
It's been kind of cool to see the individual sigils and stuff, but not nearly as cool as a painting table swooping around and going here and going there. And
especially as we get into the more complex inter-house relationships, it's going to be necessary to understand where these people are.
it'd take a 5-minute scene to explain why the Riverlands are so key.
Right.
But like, if you look at the painted table and it's like, oh, well, of course, you know, you're essentially splitting the enemy in two. Like they're their wealthiest, largest army. We've got the fleet. There's no like, yeah, you're dividing and conquering versus like, ah, oh, Riverlands are key. Must be because they got a lot of money or kind of all about the geography. It's a shame. I think they need it. And I understand why. It's like, okay, we're going to do the theme, but we got to do something unique. But like, you got a unique twist on the Game of Thrones credits. It's a fucking painted table. Mm-hmm. Just pan around the painted table, guys. Make the markers move around. Yeah, that's what I want to see next season.
Another thing I noted in this scene is the nature of Rhaenyra's life just completely changes when she becomes queen, right? She's got Queensguard, who just up her ass, like, she has to tell them to back off because you're
almost
crowding
a moment
me.
Almost like a moment of comedy. Like there's it's a farce.
That was nice. And then you've got servants coming up and your wine, my queen. This is the kind of life you have as a queen that you didn't have as a princess.
Yeah. Offering her wine or perhaps a Negroni with some prosciutto. Have you seen that meme? Man, Emma Darcy is an extremely quotable and cool person. And there's this, I don't know what it's from, but they're being interviewed, you know, like kind of some kind of gossipy thing and about like what their favorite drink is and whatnot. And they bust out this Negroni, and they got such a cool, like this Negroni.
Emma Darcy drinks Negronis?
Yeah, garnished with prosciutto, I think, is what I'm hearing. You throw
crazy.
some thinly sliced meat. I don't know. Maybe I'm not getting the joke.
That's crazy. Okay. I've never seen that, but.
You need to get on social media one of these days, Grandpa, and see what the kids are saying, because it's pretty entertaining.
Well, me and Emma can share Negronis if we ever meet, because I'm a fan.
Celebrate as Italian.
Apparently.
Yeah. I thought it's like they really sold that slow motion march to the throne room with her crown. It's like she has been transformed.
Yeah. They run down all their assets. They got 30 knights, 100 crossbowmen, 300 men at arms. And Daemon's going to run down all the dragons that they have. It looks like the Greens have 3 adults. I love how he discounts the young dragons of the Greens. Like he's just, 3 adults. That's all we have to worry about. And yet he counts Arax however you say it, in their count.
Well, but the one that he's discounting the Greens have is like a hatchling. So like
couldn't even
a 5-year-old could ride it. So yeah. So that's like I think he's, and when they're talking fighting size, you're essentially talking a Cessna. Like if it can carry a rider into battle, it's fighting size. But as we saw, the disparity between Vhagar and what's considered a fully mature adult dragon is pretty fucking amazing.
Oh yeah. But they do have a lot. They have 13, I think he claims. They're 13-3. With 12 eggs incubating. So depending on how long this war lasts, you might see some of those.
So to run it down, you've got the three dragons of Syrax, Caraxes, and Meleys. That's Rhaenyra, Rhaenys's, and Daemon's dragons. Then you got Vermax, Arax, and Taraxes, which are the three strong boys, Luke, Jace, and Joffrey. You've got Baela on Moondancer. So Laena still hasn't gotten one yet. Or no. Mm-hmm.
She perks up when Daemon says, and we have the unclaimed ones in the dragon mount.
But, you know, none of these dragons, except for probably Meleys and Caraxes, has any kind of real war experience. You got the unclaimed dragons, Sea Smoke, Vermithor, which we'll see later. That's the one that Daemon sings to, and Silverwing, which is Queen Alysanne. That's the Valyrian steel womb, 13 children over 29 years, and that's Jaehaerys's wife. So that's Jaehaerys and Jaehaerys's queen's dragons, Vermithor and Silverwing, and 3 wild dragons. Shall I tell you these wild dragons' names?
If you'd like, yeah.
Because like when I got to this point, this is something me and Anthony discussed on the podcast. Like I underlined this and like, oh fuck, these guys have to have stories behind them. The 3 wild dragons that have never been claimed by a rider are Sheep Stealer, Grey Ghost, and the Cannibal.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
Yeah, that's a dragon killing I finally got a reaction out of you. The Cannibal.
The Cannibal, yeah.
You gonna unleash the Cannibal? Who's gonna swing their leg over the Cannibal? The Cannibal's never been ridden. Why do they call it the Cannibal? It's just fucking eating dragons out there? Holy shit, there's goats and cows. It would be easier. What?
Yeah.
So like, I mean, this come is, on, sheep this is not spoilers. These were the thoughts in my head when I first read this. And I listened to all the podcasts to refresh my mind. So like, yeah. God, I kind of wish they had said it, but yeah, these are the canonical names of the three wild dragons.
Yeah, maybe they're saving that for a reveal later.
This might piss people off. If you, names of dragons are spoilers. Are names of dragons spoilers?
They can't be. It doesn't tell you anything about what's going to happen with them. No.
Yeah, you can buy their toys now. it'd be like if you could actually buy the toy set. Like Star Wars spoils itself with CDs and stuff. Anyway, stupid joke. And then that's so against the enemy dragons, you've got Vhagar, Sunfire, which is Aegon's steed, Dreamfire, which is Helena's steed, and then Tessarion is the dragon of Daeron, who is currently over in Hightower getting squired by Otto's older brother or warded. I forget, getting raised up. We haven't seen him.
Yeah, guardianed? I don't know.
Guard, yeah.
He's the ward of, yeah.
Yes, he's being warded. but yeah, his Tessarion, we haven't seen either of those, but they're counting them as part of their dragons.
Okay.
And then I said the kids, the younger children have, I think, a hatchling and a dragon egg. They're bobbling around.
Yeah, the whole scene, I'm getting the impression that Daemon wants to take over this operation. You know,
let's land in Harrenhal, cut off King's Landing, choke him down. We will have these people done before 28 days, before the moon turns, you know?
Yeah, it's dangerous, man. I saw how he handled the Stepstones and it was not even touch and go. Touch and go is generous. He was losing. He was failing.
Very Zap Brannigan. Like, I'm going to send wave after wave of my own men until... they're exhausted from killing them, right? Yeah, it didn't.
Right.
But, you know, you gain experience,
What could he possibly have learned there? He, like I said in the instinct, he sent through this big Hail Mary that shouldn't have worked.
And it did.
And it did. And yeah, you got a guy that learns from that.
You got a guy that learns bold strokes and insane risks and gambles are the way to go.
Right.
Which is, like I said, dangerous. Different than current era Daemon's characterization in the book. He's a lot more like, hey, you know, dragons can kill dragons and we don't want to unnecessarily risk ours. There's smarter ways to use them. You know, let's not be too hasty. Here he's just like, yeah, fuck yeah, let's mount up and burn this shit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's going to be interesting.
So the other thing I want to point out that, like, I don't think I've actually realized, because we talk about in Westeros, the dragons are the nuclear weapons.
Mm-hmm.
I think MAD would be a completely different doctrine, mutual assured destruction, if all of the warheads in the arsenals of the various nations had the immediate family members of the ruling person strapped to the warheads.
Yeah.
And that's something that, like, is a reality they're dealing with, is like, these aren't just dragons they're risking in combat. It's the princes. It's the royal consort. It's the aunt of the queen. It's the king himself. The king himself has to ride a dragon into battle on the other side for the greens, or they got one dragon that just can't be ridden.
Yeah.
So it's like a really interesting, do you remember, like, in this came up in like late season Leftovers, where some pacifist had this conjecture. It's like, what we should do is we should take the president's best friend and we should put the nuclear launch codes in that, like, surgically embed them in that person's heart. So that if the president wants to nuke, he's given a knife and he has to dig that fucker out of his best friend's heart to launch the... There's a little bit of that element here. Like, when you commit a dragon to the battlefield, you're committing someone you love and an irreplaceable asset. And
yeah, you're right.
That's one of the really cool angles of the dance that I never really appreciated until, again, they were fucking humanized. Because, like, in the books, it's like they're video game characters. Like, I don't even think of them as, like, thinking about the risks involved. But they really nailed it on the show.
Yeah, especially when you point out that the king has to ride one. That's a big
and
risk
his queen.
To take.
The king and his queen and his brother are who
oh,
has
boy.
The adult dragons on
yeah,
the other side.
Yeah, your entire royal family. Yeah. Yeah. I mean,
costly
the same is
battles.
True over on the black side, but they also have a lot more dragons. So they can.
You don't have
send
to. They don't
the
have
lesser,
to put the queen in the battle right. to match their strength.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a huge advantage. Huge mm-hmm. advantage. Because as reluctant as Rhaenyra is to use dragons, I think they might be just as reluctant on the green side.
They don't have many. Although, like I said, that's the fog of war. I think it's interesting that they did commit Vhagar and not mm-hmm. in defense of King's Landing, right? Like, if I was the black
yeah, totally.
Trying to think, I'd be like, well, you gotta think they're keeping Vhagar at the capital, right? It's the only thing that could protect them from all of our dragons. We got 13 to 4.
Mm-hmm.
But yet they had them just in kind of like a wild gamble, go fly over there to impress Baratheon and say, so it's...
I mean, but you can kind of count on them thinking you're going to have the dragon there, right? Because it would be so stupid to not have it there.
It's a chess match.
It is.
It's a really strategic chess match. And if you play it wrong, you fuck up, you can lose big.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. This is going to be amazing. I predict an amazing season 2.
Yeah. Should be.
Yeah. I one last thing about this scene. I love the look that Rhaenys gives Daemon when he claims that Maelys is on their side. He's like running down the list and he's like, oh yeah, we've got
she's like,
Cyrax and Caraxes and Maelys. And she's like, say what?
He's been doing it all episode long. Like every time they're like, Corlys is sailing to Dragonstone to declare for my queen. Like he's counting the eggs, dragons before they're committed. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's go. So we get this message, hey, there's a green ship approaching, and Daemon's crew meets Otto's crew out on the bridge to Dragonstone. Rhaenyra flies in on her dragon once again, and then Otto delivers Aegon's terms of surrender. Let's say they're Aegon's terms. Mm-hmm. Rhaenyra takes his hand of the kingpin and throws it into the sea. Otto gives Rhaenyra the page that she ripped out of the book, like, 8 episodes ago as a symbol of Alicent's feelings on the matter, and Rhaenyra says they'll have her answers tomorrow.
Yeah, this is something like 16 to 20 years ago when they ripped out this page.
Yeah.
What'd you think of... See, because I just kept on thinking when I was watching the scene, what a strength it is, this show. I know people didn't like the time jumps and it was confusing for people, but mm-hmm. being able to throw a moment like this in a single season... where you can call mm-hmm. back and like instantly recall all the friendship and what, just like we saw in Alicent, it wasn't easy for her to just go to war and murder these people. She didn't want to do that. It's why they're getting these. I would call these generous terms. This is essentially status quo, except for resolve all the bullshit. And also you don't get to be queen. That's the only thing that changes. Everything else, all your sons get the same shit. You're not going to be queen and your kid, but like everything else stays the same and there's no bloodshed. If you believe that,
right.
I have my doubts about 5 years hence, especially if King Aegon turns out to be a real shitty king, mm-hmm. if that equilibrium stands. But that's the offer. It's a pretty I interpret it as a pretty generous, fair offer for what they're asking.
Sure. It's just a matter of, can you trust Otto? Can you trust someone who has just usurped your claim on the Iron Throne?
Yeah. The Daemon's
I would
answer.
Say no.
Daemon's answer, it's like, I'd rather literally feed my sons to my dragons than have them mm-hmm. carry your cups and shields for this drunken usurper cunt. And, oh, by the way, let's give you our answer now. Let's give Alicent her answer now, stuffed in her father's head along with his side as withered cock.
Uh-huh.
He was ready to end it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the way he's pacing, he's the caged tiger here, right? Like,
and I also love when... the queen says no, and Daemon with great effort mm-hmm. stands down. Like it's like a multi-stage process of putting his sword away and stick it in the ground and putting in and like bowing his head. Like it's hard for him to do, as we will see here in a minute.
Yeah.
It
makes me wonder if that's going to hold, if the queen's authority is going to hold through the civil war here.
She looks the part, man. Like her eyes are blazing when Otto tries to princess her. Like, I am the queen now, you son of a bitch. Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of that in this episode, right? People calling people princess or calling them, I forget what Baratheon calls her, but Luke reminds her that, or him, that she's the queen.
Yeah,
it's very good.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting from a book reader's perspective that, like, in the books, the sigil of the Greens is a gold dragon on a black field to represent Aegon's personal steed, Sunfire, who's kind of a yellowish dragon. And they've made it a green dragon, I think, just to make, you know, because they've built this Team Green affiliation so strongly that they're just going to make that change. Or it could be the Aegon, that's his personal sigil, and, like, the side of his, like, team is going to be a green dragon. I don't know, but I thought it was an interesting change.
I'll say the one weird thing that they've done is they've just taken to having Rhaenyra call them the Greens. There was no, as best I could tell, the show just sort of appropriated that from the meta of the book or the yes, fandom or whatever. They never had a scene where they decided to call them the Greens. She just started saying the Greens. I feel like it wasn't done perfectly. I would have liked at least a scene where they figure it out.
Step up and say, you are now a council of the Greens. Like, I get it. Yeah, I get it. Like,
yeah, it's just like, and I guess everybody knows what she means.
They had the moment when she walked in the green dress, and the book makes it explicit that court started to call. But, like, the book making explicit said it became the custom. So it's not like it was decreed. It's just like people started saying, like, oh, I'm a green, I'm a green, I'm a green, I'm a black, I'm a green. And, like, it wasn't like a top down branding. It was bottom up. So it's like, I don't know.
Yeah.
How you show that. I thought the way that the fucking audience took to it, like, the second that she said, oh yeah, the greens and blacks were a thing, that moment. So, like, it does seem to have worked. I was worried about it, too. And I was, like, really struggling not to call people blacks and greens before they dropped in the episode, because that's right, the thing in the book.
Has anybody ever called their team the blacks? Rhaenyra's team? In the show yet? I don't think it has happened.
I wonder
how that's going to happen.
I thought last episode they did. But
did they? They might have.
I could be wrong.
But, yeah, I mean, you know, speaking to this, like, in name only stuff, I love when Otto says, and your true born son Jacaerys will inherit pass down Dragonstone. Yeah. I'm like, oh, now he's true born, you dick. Yeah.
But that was part, I think that's the unspoken part of the offer. We're legitimizing your bastards for all time. Like, we're gonna drop this. But also, like I said,
suits him.
It does seem that everything that King's Landing did last episode feels very on paper when you're looking at it from the other side.
Oh, except sure, but Vhagar. It's also very, like, symbolism is powerful,
it
right?
Is powerful.
And Otto, when he says he has the king's sword, he has the king's crown, he has the king's name, all of that stuff is super important to the people that he's going to be ruling over.
Especially, but if it, like, it's all centered right now on King's Landing, that's it. And King's Landing feels very isolated, so... and even giving the Baratheons on your side, if you give Team Green that, which I think fair to say, it doesn't really solve their problem of being isolated, because the Stormlands are right by the Crownlands. They don't give you any, you know, really geographic control over anything that you don't already have.
And I do think that, I think it's Rhaenyra who says this in the episode, but the Starks have never broken an oath. I think they will have the Starks and the North on their side. That's my assumption, because that is the story they told me in Game of Thrones, that the Starks are extraordinarily honorable.
Yeah, it made me really smile when they said, like, even in this era, that the fucking Starks are solid. Like, if they, like, it might be stupid, but if they swore an oath, right, they swore they're going to
get them all beheaded.
Like, it's not even a question.
Yes. And I think that will hold. Though.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you my other interesting question. How big of a knee kick to the crotch will it be to the fans that the Starks do turn cloak?
Oh, my God. I mean, then you're looking at a rebellion the likes of what happened on Rings of Power every time they changed a piece of lore, right?
Like, no, that's why Ned's so, because he's still smarting. House Stark's still getting over that one smirch in their honor.
He's got something to prove.
That's why he's such a stubborn ass. He's doubled down on that. Yeah.
Come on, man.
Craven Cregan is what they call him in the books.
Oh, boy. Yeah, well, I'll look for that in season 2.
Yeah, yeah. But for real, it's going to be hilarious. No. But maybe. No,
it will really suck if they can't get some of the other Riverlands people that they need, the Riverlands houses.
And again, if you look at the map of Westeros, the Riverlands is one of the fucking poor kingdoms that bleeds every time there's a war, because they essentially they stand in the path of every other major power. You can't get from, because of all the weird peninsulas and jetties and how narrow it is, you can't, none of the other major powers can get anywhere else without trampling across the Riverlands.
Yeah.
So they are the linchpin. You need all the others for the boots on the ground, but you're not going to get anywhere unless you can control the Riverlands.
Mm-hmm. All right. Rhaenyra is reluctant to use dragons and is considering giving up her claim to the Iron Throne to preserve the peace of the realm. Daemon is pissed about it. She reminds him about the Song of Ice and Fire, but he has no idea what she's talking about. And then he chokes her and tells her dreams didn't make us dragons, or dreams didn't make us dragons or kings. The dragons did. Sorry, I botched that.
Oh, no. I was just thinking of how to proceed, because, like, I understand this scene a lot more than I did, you know, in when I first saw it. Mm-hmm. You know, I've been thinking about, there's a lot going into this, like Daemon's impatience, like maybe his fearing that his wife is going to be too weak to do what needs to be done to protect her house. Mm-hmm. Him giving a literal object lesson about the value of strength and power over, you know, rules and niceties and diplomacies. He's not the thing is that Daemon's not a good person. Like, sure. If you're a husband and you're going to essentially bully your wife to make a rhetorical point, that you're not a good person. Mm-hmm. And like, you know, whether he does cool stuff or not, like, yeah, like, I think this is the show's reminder of the fact that, like, yeah, he's not been gentled, you know. But also it's a reminder of the show that, like, from Rhaenyra's perspective, like, she expects a certain amount of burning together, and that she's not cowed by this, because as soon as he lets go of her windpipe, she comes right back with, like, ha, like, laughing.
He didn't tell you. Yeah.
My father never even told. So, like, I don't think she was necessarily fearing for her life.
No.
But, like, again, I say this as a pretty burly man that has never really been in much physical fear of my life. So, like, I don't know. But, like, the way that she kind of, like, just came right back at him. Again, I wouldn't want to model this behavior in my relationship. But I understand where it came from. What do you concur with my analysis, or?
Yeah, absolutely. And I really like what they did in prior episodes to show us this fire that's burning in this relationship. But it's not a smooth and calm surface here. There is a lot of passion, passion for different things, passion for each other. And a lot of will there, on both sides of this, that I think is at times clashing and at times working in solidarity. And I think that is extremely interesting and complex.
And this is something that is tracks clean for his character. The Daemon is, you know, remember how much he hates Otto, the second son, conniving, scheming, inferior, worth. This is how he views himself too. This is an old wound for Daemon. The fact that we've been speculating all season, but Viserys never took Daemon seriously as an heir because he never told him about the Song of Ice and Fire. And this is kind of like a fresh slap from the grave in Daemon's face.
Which at the risk of repeating myself is still fucking wild that he never said anything to Daemon, but there it is. He didn't. So
I tentatively have something set up with Kim Renfro, the co-host of A Cast of Kings, to talk about, because, like, I want to talk about how they've used this prophecy throughout the season, because it's one of the qualms I have. It doesn't seem like it added in almost anything, and some points it kind of takes away, because, like, I feel like the Targaryens are fundamentally unserious about the Song of Ice and Fire. Because, like, you might not think much of Daemon, but, like, don't you have to say something? Because if you don't, what happens
with
if you choke on, you choke on a fishbone tomorrow, and you've told no one, you know? And the fact that means his brother never considered him as an heir at all. Like, They've really done a good job of showing that that's a big thing to Daemon. And again, you shouldn't try to choke your wife out. WWE style, but
so I've heard.
I think that's what's going into the relationship. They are not a healthy power dynamic. And that's the other thing is, like, they've always had an unbalanced power dynamic. You know, she was a little girl, naive about the world. He was the older, wiser, mature uncle. That has kind of turned now that she's older and, you know, the queen and has actual real power. And I feel like that's something that he, like, it's all easy to bow and, like, my queen. But then when she's, like, not agreeing with you, it's a real fucking bummer.
Yeah.
So Damon,
and you're so fired up to go kill these people who have been tormenting you for decades now.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you've got your opportunity. Yeah. It's, you've got your license too, right? I mean, this is an act of war.
Right.
Yeah. As he says. So,
because it's a thing. It's like, you know, it's like she says, what do you expect me to make the realm burn because I'm angry? He's like, no, I expect you to defend it as the queen against rebellion, which fair enough.
Sure. And the other, I like that they both have valid points of view here.
And the other thing is, like, also Damon, this, he sees his brother as a dreamer, a literal dreamer, as a problem. Like, you know, he mentioned this, like, I love that word, feckless. This is the thing, that one thing that redeems my brother's feckless rule. And the fact that, like, it's surfacing now in his wife and it's causing him to not take vengeance for, it's like, it must be supremely frustrating. And again, you know, choking is a demonstrating, like, here's your dream of an ice and fire where you're this important thing. Like, I could kill you right now. And what's the dream going to do?
Dream's gone.
Yeah. There's still lots of hot D to talk about. We'll be back right after the break. And now back to hot D.
No, I love it. And especially because we know that the prophecy is correct in a roundabout way, right? Like, Damon is kind of fighting fate here.
And it doesn't win.
And there's that extra little bit of, oh God, he's so wrong and he's doing bad things to prove how right he is. And yeah.
And conversely, it's a slap in the face to Rhaenyra to Damon from the grave, but it's an attaboy that, like, actually your dad did take you seriously as an heir. Because he took you in confidence day one of that shit, where Damon, he was like, oh yeah, you're the heir, all right, buddy, you're on Dragonstone. So it reaffirmed her legitimacy by her father from beyond the grave. And I think that's part of what kind of made her kind of glow with you know, defiance of her fuckboy husband, but also like, oh my God, my dad really did love and see me as an heir, you know?
And makes it all the more important that she try to unite the realm no matter what the cost is, like she says.
Yes.
Yeah. All right. Corlys wakes up to find Rhaenys sitting by his bed. Excuse me, Rhaenys. She tells him now how his brother died and chastises him for leaving them when they needed him most. And then she convinces him to pledge for Rhaenyra. So he goes into the hall and pledges their dragons and ships. And as a bonus, Corlys already holds the Narrow Sea, which they plan to, I guess, drain. You could drain the Narrow Sea in preparation for a siege of King's Landing.
Not literally. So, like, I thought they did a really good job.
Drain it of ships?
Because remember,
is that what they mean when they drain it?
Remember what Corlys said in the first episode, that if they neglect the threat that the Triarchy to the Stepstones, they will cut off trade in the Narrow Sea and beggar King's Landing. And he said, that's what we cannot allow to happen. And what he is saying is, we're going to deliberately do this and beggar King. So, like, you don't have to understand, but you have to understand that, like, the best sea captain in the whole fucking world, by his estimation, you can cut off all trade to the sea. And again, it's not like you've got super highways running across Westeros. So it's like, oh, we had all this tonnage of stuff going to King's Landing from the Reach and from here and from there, and we're just going to 500 miles ship it across in caravans and wagons. Like, that would take time in a medieval society. So, like, long term, maybe you could survive, but how the hell are you going to? And I also wondered, them establishing that they got rid of the treasure out of King's Landing as a way to avoid being sacked and it all, you know, losing everything in one throw. I wonder if that'll work against them if they can successfully encircle. It's like, you've got the treasury, we don't have access to it, but try to get to your ATM to get it out, you know? So, yeah, I think, and, you know, they mention, like, and again, I just look at a map of Westeros. This isn't spoilery. And the what they're describing here is, like, King's Landing is in the shape of, like, a crab's claw. and like the northern pincher, they've got the house that controls that. The southern pincher that they call Massey's Hook, they got the house that controls that already sworn to them. They've already gotten the ravens back from them. And Rhaenys is willing to patrol the gullet, which is a stretch of water that goes between Dragonstone and that southern point, that Massey's Claw. It's a very stretch. Mm-hmm. So if Melis can just like literally vaporize any ship that goes across that 10, 15, maybe 20 miles, and they've got King's Landing completely isolated from the sea. I thought they did a pretty good job of describing that, but I did see a lot of show only watchers kind of struggling with it.
No, I felt like in a single shot they managed to convey almost everything, right? Like you've got Corlys saying what's going to happen here, talking about the gullet, and kind of moving his hand over the bay as he's saying it. And I felt like, oh, I got everything I needed from that. I see where this could be a siege potential.
Yeah, and I think that Rhaenyra is wise to, like, I don't want the first stroke of war to fall on me because, you know, I don't want to be a Kingslayer. I don't want to be a Kinslayer. I don't, like, to me, this is a PR problem. I've got an usurper. If we, you know, like if we encircle them, it'll be an easy matter to starve them out. No one has to die, except, of course, the small folk. They're going to starve. No one has to die. We can settle this peacefully, and that's best for the realm.
Yeah. And that's clearly what she wants, is what's best for the realm.
I also like when, you know, Jace steps up and volunteers, it should be us. Like, fuck the ravens, dragons can fly faster, and it shows we're serious. Like, Corlys backs that play in exactly the same way that he backed Rhaenyra's play when, you know, Daemon kidnapped the dragon egg, and everybody's like, what should we do? She's like, just send me on a dragon, I'll fly over there. And Corlys is like, fuck yeah, let's send the princess. And everybody else is like, nah, I can't do it. He is now, and I wonder if there's like, because like I felt like when I was watching this in subsequent attempts, there's on Emma's face, you can see that there is some kind of like, oh fuck, I'm being hoisted by my own petard here. these are the impetuous youth wanting to use their dragons, and I'm supposed to say no to them.
Right. No, it's. I called it a little naive in the instant take, and I still think there's a tinge of that. I think the idea that you would send your heirs out at a time when you know your heirs are going to be first up on the chopping block, and to places that you know already have offers from your enemy, it's a dangerous gamble.
Yeah.
And I think it would have worked fine here if not for Aemond. Although we haven't seen Jace's end of you know, the Winterfell and the Eyrie stuff, but we'll find out more about that in season two. But I still think it's a little naive. But it's the kids suggesting it, and it's her like kind of letting them earn it, right? Like she says to Luke earlier, you're gonna have to earn this Lord of Driftmark status. It's not something you're just going to be given necessarily.
And if you take your loved ones being strapped to the nuclear bomb aspect of it off the table, she is risking their second and third string dragons. Like all their mainline dragons are not being risked except for like melees, I guess. So like it's like it's a huge gesture and the lords will take it as such that in a divided realm, it's such a huge show of confidence. I'm sending my sons and their relatively small dragons. I'm not Vhagar who. We're not afraid of that. Vhagar's stuck at the keep protecting the fucking illegitimate king. So like I thought it's a gutsy play, but it's the exact type of play they need to make to sew this up early.
For sure.
And I also like how Corlys came in and challenged Rhaenyra. He didn't just like throw his sword into the pile. He's like verbally sparred with her to test her. Like, you know, like
this is all you've got.
She got the brains. Can she stand up to it? Like if this sick old man who just had his throat torn out can challenge her, but like she passes his test.
Yeah. I love the transformation there. And we didn't really talk much about the Corlys and Rhaenys scene, but I really like that scene. I think like Corlys realizing that all of his efforts, this is the scene I wish that Otto could have at some point. Just looking back on his life, his choices, and going, that was such a colossal mistake. Yeah. I have plunged the realm into war. I have done all these terrible things for the sake of my own ambition. And what has it gotten me?
Yeah, this was Walt.
Otto will never have that scene. Otto's a full piece of shit through and through. But well, Corliss having this change of heart. Otto is a piece of shit. I cannot be shaken.
A man can regret.
Can
have regrets. No. And a man can triumph, by the way. This isn't a foregone.
A man can. Otto cannot.
Oh, boy. Oh, boy. But speaking of Calendar but Corliss do hatched.
It. Yeah, I thought this scene with Corliss was amazing. And Ray is telling it like it is. Like, you left us. We needed you. This is a situation for us to deal with, not for you to deal with.
And also, I thought the deeper thing between Rainus and Corliss is that he still is playing this like checkers. Like, Rainus is like, you poor fool. You've already risked and lost everything. Now our grandkids are on the line. Now our grandkids are on the line and you want to pull back. Like, this is the time to be bold, you moron. Like, he completely misread the situation because he never really properly counted the cost. He's just like, oh, I've got these coins and the idea that you'd have to spend them for real to lose them never entered his imagination. And he, in his way, is kind of a sweet summer child.
Yeah, so we find out at the end of that scene, Jace and Luke are going to go fly off to Winterfell, the Eyrie, and Storm's End. And Rhaenyra tells the children to behave themselves when they're out there. Mm-hmm. And they both swear they won't get into any fights. And then she gives them the messages they're to deliver and sends them on their way.
Yeah, she has them swear on the what I assume is the seven-pointed star, which is the Faith of the Seven's Bible, essentially, their oldest holy book. Mm-hmm. And I thought it was an interesting detail about Cregan. First of all, they're calling him Cregan. I've always pronounced it Cregan. So this is going to be an adjustment. Don't want to mispronounce things like Rhaenys. Imagine if you called the queen of Never Was Rhaenys. Imagine if you said something that Rhaenys? Fucking stupid.
Yeah.
But yeah, I want to get it off straight. It's Cregan. And apparently he's close to the same age. He's a young man like Jace here.
Okay. That'll be interesting.
But they mentioned like in the book, and I think they made it pretty explicit that they're giving Jace the harder, more risky flight. Like, he's going to be covering a lot of ground, going to the Riverlands, going to the far north in Winterfell, going to the Eyrie. These are pretty remote, far flung east, west, north locations. Lots of travel. Luke, they're descending over to Blackwater, essentially to the next bay over to close to home. To Baratheons, where you've got family ties. Although, god damn it, does Rhaenyra actually think that these are Laenor's kids? Because she's acting like, like, just because the king went along with this fiction, you're sending this kid to the Baratheons, trusting on his grandmother's blood, which none of the other realms legit recognizes. I thought that was foolish of her. In retrospect.
And now that Viserys is dead and there's a new king on the throne, they're free to point that out to her. Yeah. Whereas they were not before.
Yeah. So, it always seemed like the Baratheons kind of had bad blood about, you know, the Rhaenys situation. So like, I thought like, wow, that always, that felt risky, even though on paper it's like, looks like the milk run. It always seemed like it was a risky play.
She recognizes in this scene that Boros is a very proud man, is what she says, and then he'll be happy to host the prince. I feel like she really overlooked the idea of bringing an offering, you know, not just reminding him of an oath. If he's a proud man, he's going to want something as well.
But. So many of their other wins, though, like, firmly finally wedding their house to Valyrian, that was the cost. She doesn't have very many chips in that land. And what are you going to do?
Right? Give him, she's got Joffrey.
He's a Lord Paramount. The you'd have to give him the someone else's lordship or the Iron Throne to get a promotion. Like,
yeah,
you know, if you can't marry into the royal family, it's a huge disadvantage. And also, people need to understand that this is not, I think they made this explicit, but this is not the same Baratheon that was the old knight jousting in the first tournament that was like sweet on Rhaenys. This is his son. So this guy never knelt, never promised, never swore an oath to Rhaenyra personally.
The person on that third dragon is Rhaenys, I assume. She's going off to
patrol the gullet. Yeah, that was obvious on second watch, but
yes,
big red dragon.
All right, Daemon goes down into the dragon mount. I don't know, they spell it weird, and sings to a very large dragon.
Yeah, this is Vermithor, the Bronze Fury. He's the personal steed of King Jaehaerys, the old king before Viserys. Nearly 100 years old, which I thought was kind of like middle age prime for a dragon, but the books describe him as hoary old Vermithor. He definitely looks old, even mm-hmm. though he's only, you know, like I think Vhagar is only 50, 60 years older than him. Maybe she's extraordinary, but like, and Beleriand died at 200. So, but yeah, he looks looks like an old but huge dragon. Like,
yeah.
Maybe not a match for Vhagar, but a little bit more in her weight class. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And, big dragon. So I thought this was an interesting scene. You got the dragon comes out and just roaring fire, which I took to mean essentially, yes, I have, it's a fucking banger. I haven't heard this song in 20 years. Like, he's really got a, really carried a torch literally for this song. But what did you, so what did you get with the pupil action? What did you get, King Jaehaerys, as a non-book reader? What did you get from the pupil action at the end of the scene?
I felt like he was just making a connection with this dragon, and I don't know if it's going to, like, if he's planning on trading up. Like, sorry, Caraxes, you're done. I'm now riding Vermithor. Or if this is more just like, hey, maybe I'll get Laena this really good dragon.
Hmm. It felt like they were suggesting there was some kind of actual bond forming, which was wild to me.
It does.
Yeah,
I'm telling you, JCVD splits
that was
two dragons at the same time.
Jean-Claude Van Damme style. He's riding two dragons, the split kick between them. Yeah, I mean, who fucks with them? That's how you take out Vhagar. Two for one, baby.
Dragon pontoons, and Daemon is the ship.
So David J. Peterson, occasional guest host on Electric Boogaloo, and also the writer of all the fictitious languages. In Westeros, Dothraki, and High Valyrian, gave a translation for this song. This is an original song that he and one of the show writers came up with. Do you want to know the translation?
Sure.
Fire breather, winged leader, but two heads to a third sing. From my voice, the fires have spoken. The price has been paid with blood magic, with words of flame, and with clear eyes. To bind the three, to you I sing. As one we gather, and with three heads, we shall fly as we were destined, beautifully, freely.
All right. That's two dragons, one rider stuff.
Yeah, like, I was wondering, like, what is the third thing that, like, because it seems like you got the rider, you got the dragon. This was something that, you know, that Rhaegar was always saying, the dragon must have three heads, the Targaryen crest has three heads. What does it literally mean, though? You've got,
two dragons and one daemon equals three heads, right?
Two dragons, one daemon?
That's what I'm saying. Yeah, I think it's going to happen.
Going to have an MDD three-way? All right. That's an interesting... Because I was thinking of, like, what is the other entity? Is there some kind of, like, old Valyrian god that they're appealing to? But you're like, you're like, yeah, maybe this is just a... This is what this is how the Targaryens sing to have a dragon menagerie. I don't know.
Yeah.
But that's interesting.
I don't know. That's my headcanon.
They got the three heads mentioned in there, the two heads becoming three. They got the blood magic. That was an interesting kind of detail of it. I thought it was cool. Mm-hmm. And it's a great scene. It's a nice addition to the lore. Daemon being this literal kind of like dragon whisperer, master of dragon canon. I like it.
All right, Luke arrives at Storm's End and meets with Boros Baratheon. Unfortunately, all he has to offer Boros is a message from his mother reminding him of his oath. And Aemond is already there with a much better offer of marriage. Aemond demands that Luke cut out his eye, but Boros stops them from fighting in his hall. And we could probably do this whole scene. Luke flies away from Storm's End, but Aemond pursues him, taunting him threateningly. And Luke almost gets away, but his dragon... Arax, I don't know how you say it, decides to spit fire in Vhagar's face, and Vhagar takes offense to that and bites both Luke and his dragon in half.
Yeah, that's what I had in my notes. Like, this is a full magic or Michael Jordan, The Last Dance, you know.
And I took, yeah,
like this pissant dragon spit fire in my face, and I took offense to that. And then I dropped 30 points on the fourth quarter on him, posterized him twice. Yeah. I mean, the scale of Vhagar, Like when she first lifts her head above the ramparts of Storm's End, and it's like something that it would take 10 mana to cast in a Magic the Gathering deck. Like it's just like, it's so fucking huge. And then when you see Luke trying like desperately to fly away from her, like in the storm, and like that shadow you see, holy shit. It was, this was so well done. And like, I think as a, you know, they kind of fucked with me as a book reader, but as a show watcher, you probably, a lot of people probably breathing sighs of relief that like, oh, this was a tease. This was showing like some dangerous brinksmanship, but Luke's going to live to fight another day. And that's kind of what I thought. Like, oh, well, it's like, this is going to be an interesting change, but Arrak's taking it too, like getting into the emotions of its writer, these young boys, inexperienced, not strong enough to get overrule their dragon's emotions that they're feeding into. I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, I got a lot of Nope vibes from this, like the movie Nope that came out recently, because of how gracefully and silently these dragons move through the air and how wild they are in actuality.
There's like huge things moving in cloud cover, and like it's like a sky predator stalking prey. It's and just how effortlessly, I don't know whether the darkness and the rain helped, but like this is the best dragon riding's ever looked. And they have this really one shot where it's like a, it's kind of a, it's a far off shot of Arrak and Luke riding him, and they kind of zoom in and zoom in and zoom in onto his saddle, and it's like just looks seamless. They finally nailed it.
I think so. I don't think it's ever looked better. I will say, back when Rhaenyra got off her dragon at Dragonstone on the bridge, they didn't show her dismount again. They're playing it smart with some of these effect shots.
Save your money for when you need it. But I thought just, like it's like this came across like the opening of Star Wars, like the blockade runner running from this Imperial Star Destroyer. It's just, it's an iconic scene. I'm delighted that I was worried that people would see, they'd either not do the sapphire eye because of the eye patch, or the people would think it was goofy, but I thought it looked cool, and it looks like the vast majority of people thought it was cool.
Me too.
Lord Baratheon talking a lot of shit here, but he's got a point. You know, he's got one king that's already in control and running stuff and giving him generous offers, and then you've got you that are just impudently reminding me of my father's oaths.
Yeah. Not a lot of...
And the cost of Rhaenyra's diplomacy thus far has left her to where she's got no real chits to bargain with.
Yeah, it's true. I don't know. I'm thinking about, okay, how does this affect the sort of status quo we have so far with Aemond, not intentionally, but definitely killing Luke. And there was already this rivalry seeming to be brewing between Aemond and Daemon. But this final scene here doesn't focus on Daemon. This final scene focuses on Rhaenyra, where Daemon tells her the news and she gets the Eye of the Tiger.
What
she is clearly out for blood now. It's amazing. But they're not talking about the consequences with Daemon. They're talking about the consequences with her, because she's the one who's thus far has been keeping them out of this war.
Yep.
That's about to change. Yep. Obviously, that's about to change.
Yep. And I thought Emma had a really interesting point in the after show where they said, you know, Rhaenyra's story is that she thinks she knows grief. She's lost friends. She's lost both of her parents. And now she loses a child, something that maybe she never expected to do. And like she's found this whole other dimension of grief that's completely unexplored. And that this is, in her mind, going to change her forever. And I wonder if,
with
like,
all the
season
stuff,
two, you're going to see Rhaenyra coming out a lot more fire and blood and a lot less, you know. Like, she's going to get on Allison's page at this point, where it's like, you know, fuck these greens.
Yeah, it's a shame with all the stuff she was talking about, how she's not going to rule with fear and not give in to her emotions. She's going to play this rationally. And you look at... Otto, who is on the other side of this, I feel like he's just as emotionless about this whole situation, but I don't know. Maybe that's what they need. Maybe they need a little fire on that side to combat the kind of lack of fire on the green side. I don't see a lot of, until you get Aegon involved, I feel like that's where the fire is going to come from, over on the green side.
Yeah,
but he's been a non-player thus far. I don't know. It'll be interesting, man. Season two.
It's real interesting because in the books, there's no hint at all that Aemon did this with any kind of regret. And I thought it's such a fascinating change because, like, and then the way they portrayed it, too, it's like he's got this great moment where he's like Michael Scott or like MacGruber fucking up, where it's like, no, Vhagar, no, no, God, no, what'd you do? Like, he's like, the way he said no and all that, I thought was really funny.
I loved it.
But the look on his face is like, he's now got a choice. You are now a kinslayer, which means a hell of a lot in this realm. Mm-hmm. Like, it's social taboo. Probably even worse than bastardry, being a kinslayer. You drew first blood. You got to go back and face your mother and your grandpa and your brother saying that you've done this unprovoked. Or you have to admit that you've lost control of the biggest, largest dragon in the world. And I think it's going to be fascinating on the ride home what decision he makes, what truth he tells. And then assuming the Otto knows the truth, there's no fucking way that gets out of the greens because they'd have to admit that they don't really have control of the world's largest dragon, which would be hugely fatal to them politically.
The third option is he denies that he was there. He denies that he had anything to do with it. And because we don't know how they found out that Luke was killed, right?
This is true.
But Boros could blow up his spot. Like, I saw them fighting and I saw how they went at each other in the hall, and Aemon instigated it. And
That's mildly interesting. The fact that you
feel like he's just gonna own it.
Deny. Yeah, because that kind of makes you look weak. That's the thing. Like, I gotta say, my first reaction is I like Aemon slightly less because I kind of admire a guy who got bullied in a certain way. I don't condone it, but I admire a person who now is in a position to repay that with Litecoin. You know, it's kind of like Ender from Ender's Game.
Stand up for yourself is a better option, but if you want to repay it, sure.
And here's the guy. Well, and it's also like it was like 3-4 to 1 at some points. Like, I don't know how much standing up you can do other than the stuff you already did. But and he kills this just out of pettiness and spite. That's fucking cool. This isn't cool. Cooling somebody by accident because you lost control of your dragon is not cool.
Yeah, that's why I think he's going to own it. He's going to come back and say, yes, I killed him.
I think so, too.
Yes, this was first blood. This was a war that needed to be started. Otherwise, the realm will never deal with this. I think he's going to
own it. What does Otto do? Because Otto is going to fucking lose it. But what's he going to do? Because he's no Charles Dance. He's no Tywin. Nope. And Tywin had his hands full of keeping Joffrey unchecked. So... Mm-hmm. You know, because what's Aegon? Like, Aegon, if he's like, yo, bro, I killed that little pissant Luke and his dragon. Chomp, chomp, you should have been there. 4 pieces. It was like, and like, Aegon's like, going to bring it back. Sick. You know, you think he's going to like castigate his brother for bull? No. You know, fuck no. So,
sick. Let me show you the project I've been working on.
Yeah.
He's got sharp teeth and pointy nails.
I know our dragon's teeth are sharp, but have we considered making them sharper? Fitting with some Valyrian steel, caps and inserts. Like, have we considered that?
Yeah.
Man, this is this is such a great, like, we talked about it before, like the performance of Rhaenyra, you know, Daemon taking her to side and you can see her crumple and like, you know, falter. But then like her back straightens and when she turns, it's like something else. There's this vein standing out on her forehead. Like she's looking right at the camera. It's like, fuck, it's incredible.
I keep remembering that line from Game of Thrones about killing the boy, and I can't help but feel that they accidentally killed the girl here, and now they're going to have to deal with the woman, Rhaenyra.
Yeah.
And it is not going to be pleasant for the Greens.
Yeah. I thought that's made something someone said in the behind the scenes. I thought that was exactly like somebody said that, like, yeah, this is the final death of the last vestiges of her. Or maybe I think it's that they're talking about Aemon, but I think it works for her too. Like, this is the immature kind of devil may care. Oh, isn't being queen fun? Because it turns out there aren't any rules and restrictions, or you know, princess fun. Like that's gone. It's all business now.
Yeah, and gone is season one. of this show. I thought it was great. I'm super excited for season two. What do we have in the future for this?
Well, we're not done. We have a feedback episode Thursday. Next week, we're going to have a wrap-up podcast, which I'm... there's a bunch of stuff I want to talk about, and I'm trying to decide like how much material I'll have and whether I want to like extend it, because I do also want to talk with Jim some like book versus show stuff, because was a lot of like choose your own adventure. I think that would be something interesting to talk about. Got to see how much time and stuff we have. So we got like two more podcasts that will be opportunities for you to give your feedback. HotD@baldmove.com. HotD@baldmove.com. And then again, we'd like for you to stay with us and go on to other projects. As I mentioned up top, we've got The Walking Dead right now. We got this 1899 time traveling project from Netflix, which is we're looking forward to. We got Wakanda Forever. We got some Christmas celebration coming up. Next year, we're looking forward to debut of The Last of Us, Yellowjacket, Severance, Foundation returning. A lot of great science fiction, a lot of great fantasy. Continuing coverage on this feed of Hot D. Anthony's going to continue doing his chapter by chapter analysis of Clash of Kings. And then if you want to get all of that, Bald Move Pulp is what you want to subscribe to. If you search for that in your favorite podcast app, that's got all of our science fiction fantasy coverage. And we do a lot of it. But like I said, we'll be back from time to time to talk about Hot D news, Jon Snow sequel news, and Anthony will be holding down his feed. And then, yeah, we'll be back for season two when it drops, for sure. For sure. Mm-hmm. Wild dragons couldn't drag us away. But yeah, that'll do it for this week. Follow us on twitter.com/baldmove, another great way to keep abreast of everything that we're doing. And if you'd like to support us, if you think we've done a good job, you don't have to join the club. There's a various ways. There's lots of merch. We just got the Keeping It Leal merch, by the way. If you want to identify as Team Black or Team Green, check that out, merch.baldmove.com. But all you can find all that stuff at support.baldmove.com. Thank you again for being with us. You know, we have been towards the tops of the charts and TV and film with this podcast. I've seen a lot of people recommend us on social media, sharing our stuff on Twitter. Got a lot of solid recommendations. Saw us a lot of people recommending us on the House of the Dragon subreddit and other places as your favorite podcast at, or your favorite podcast for this. So really appreciate all the support. Everybody's rated and reviewed us. It means a lot. And you've helped us. I think we've fought our way towards the top of the independent podcaster pile. We're still below the official and the networked up people. But for scrappy upstarts, I think we punched above our weight, and it's because of your guys' support. So thank you. We'll be back in a couple days for feedback. Until then, I'm your host, Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
See ya.